This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Everyone, thanks for being here. You all deserve a pat on the back for being prompt after the dinner break. It's not easily done. So we are very lucky to have with us tonight Rob Larson. He is an economics professor, but it's okay. He's on our side and uses his powers for good, not evil. His writing can be found at Current Affairs, where he is the economics editor, as well as at Jacobin and Dollars and Cents. You can also find his writing in three books, including most recently Bit Tyrants, as well as what we're going to be discussing tonight, Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. Let's welcome Rob Larson.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to take my mask off briefly up here because if I lecture without it, it makes me dizzy. But I do have a negative COVID test up here right now, so I can prove that if people are skeptical. All right, so it's good to see you all. Like Rachel said, yes, I'm Rob Larson. I'm an economics professor, but for a community college, so don't be too impressed, you know. It's not so much like an ivory tower as like a particle board tower. Like, if that was possible, like, that is the kind of institution where I work. And I've been teaching for 19 years. I should not include that. 19 years. I was young at one time. It was very exciting. But I just finished a three-year project learning about the richest households in the world and their wealth. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So if you're like me, and I know I am, you open up the paper every day and you see some horrifying stuff. We have a lot of rising violence in the world. We have decreasing average incomes in the United States, and indeed decreasing lifespans, life expectancy, I should say, for a large part of the citizenry, even as global wealth and American wealth continues to grow. We do have a $25 trillion GDP in this country. I mean, those were 2023 numbers, but that, you know, gives you a sense of it. And so we're watching that, and also, of course, pandemics thrashing our austerity, undermined public health systems. And of course, we have climate change slowly but surely baking, soaking, and burning large areas of the world. So the point I just want to make is that all of that, like all of that, is just for the benefit of a very small number of people and their families. A very limited, numerically limited number of people in different countries with different specific characteristics around the world. But basically, we're looking at a ghastly rogues gallery of remote ruling class bastards that dominates global decision making and obviously controls a lot of wealth. And so fundamentally, it just comes to see that the power of these elites has to get broken up, or we're just utterly screwed ourselves. Like, we don't really have a second option. So that's what we'll talk about tonight. So the first thing that I always talk about with the ruling class, whether it's in person or in the book or whatever, is just to briefly just remind everyone of the scale of the issue, just some of the numbers there. So just very, very briefly here, I will say maybe first that most of the statistical material in my own book, in my own work is based on these guys, the World Inequality Database. This is the first room I've worked in a while without a screen. So imagine that you're seeing on a screen a large, attractive data visualization display. It's the World Inequality Database, and they have an extremely good mission towards public understanding of the scale of today's wealth concentration, and you can pull up by now specific graphs for almost every country in the world and see what the concentration of income is, what the concentration of wealth looks like, which is a pretty handy little resource. But just going with a few of the numbers here so we can move on to the juicier stuff. So going back to 2022, the last year we have good data on in this regard, the richest 1%, the wealthiest 1% of households by net assets, owned 35% of all American wealth. The bottom half, 1.5%, which is smaller. A much, much smaller amount. It might seem impossible, but of course, when we're measuring wealth, we have to take your wealth and subtract your debts, of course. Obviously, debts and, you know, negative balances, that counts as negative wealth. So that's pretty intense. Globally, the numbers are pretty close. So the wealthiest 1% of households globally owns 40% of wealth, the bottom half, 1.6%. And there's a lot more details and breaking down of this data, and a lot of interesting stuff you can see with that. And I spent some time doing that in the book and my other work online. You can take a look if you want to get into more of the details. But the two just last statistics I'll mention, just briefly, is if you talk to most people like me, most of my professional economics colleagues, what you're going to hear is, well, yes, the wealth gap is a concern, of course. You hasty leftists with your taxation and expropriation and so on. Most embarrassing, we're serious economists here. The way to fix the wealth gap is to grow the economy. Much less offensive to the people that fund my department or my political party. And of course, just meaning if we produce more goods and services each year than we did last year, that's economic growth, means there's a bigger pie to go around. And even if we don't get fair shares of the pie, yes, you crazy socialists, it is true that you will get a bigger share every year. So, like, that's pretty good. So that's a common argument you'll encounter. But we need to mention that over the last 40 years, data just through 2018 here, but from 1980 through that year, the richest 1% of households took home 27% of the growth in per capita wealth. Like, the majority of it is itself disproportionately going to those wealthy households, which of course already have so much money that additional wealth is not necessarily even something that you would like notice. And we'll get to that in a second there. But just to say, like, more growth does mean, yes, and my rich friends still eat first and you get little crumbs. But they're bigger crumbs than last year, huh? That's why is no one smiling? You have masks on. Maybe you are smiling. No one knows. So that's of interest. But just the very last statistic that I will bore you with is this. I think this is an especially important point, and I always hit this hard, and I have a whole section on it in the book. You should be advised about the connection between the wealthy households and the corporate world, which is something that I think people sometimes have separate in their minds, perhaps. So there's not a gigantic amount of research on this subject. The main papers on this are published by a New England economist, Edward Wolfe, in some very good papers he wrote for the National Bureau of Economic Research. And just to boil it down to the headline sentence, so the first thing is, you know, we talk about stock and ownership of corporate stock. Realize corporations, they make a profit or they buy something. Who benefits from that? Well, they're stockholders. Most big corporations are owned through stock. And if you buy a stock or a share in Amazon or Microsoft or Walmart or whomever, you own a tiny piece of the company. And therefore, you get a tiny piece of that company's profit, which we call a dividend payment. Or these days, they do it through buybacks, which is a similar process. But that's pretty important. And the thing, again, you'll hear from my colleagues, who are not at all comfortable and overfed and complacent in any way. You'll hear them say, well, don't you know, you might criticize corporate America, but you're really just being childish. You're being childish in criticizing them because you don't realize America is an ownership society now. It's great. Everyone owns stock now. You do. You do. Don't give me that look. You have some. And this is something that is used to say, like, you may remember George W. Bush, who was a president at one time. He said that it's an ownership in society, in the United States now. It's an ownership society, and everyone owns some of the corporations, so no one's really mad at corporations anymore. One financial crash and Occupy Wall Street movement later, apparently people were mad at businesses after all, so go figure. But the big thing you would hear is that most American households own stock. And of course, for the huge majority of us, including people like me who have professional class jobs who actually do own a little stock, you own it very indirectly through the mutual funds in your retirement account that your employer may or may not feel like giving you. So I have some shares in a mutual fund, meaning I have shares of companies somewhere. This is what finance is all like. Okay. But the interesting thing is that since 2008, that proportion of that share of households that owns any corporate equity has decreased pretty significantly. By now, a small, it's a minority now, 46.9% of households own some stock. And again, that can mean a few mutual fund shares in the retirement account from the job you quit a while ago. All right. But as long as you have any, we count you in that category. It's still a minority of households, but the really crucial point that Wolf found was this. In 2016, when he published this research, I wish we had newer numbers, the top 1% of households by wealth owned 40% of all corporate equity, of all corporate stock. And the wealthiest 10% owned 84%, which is, you know, the large majority. That's nearly all of it. All right. So that's pretty important. It means when you see huge corporate growth or these crazy corporate valuations now, Microsoft, for example, is a $3 trillion firm now, going by its market capitalization. Just an incomprehensible value there, you know, the amount of money. Mainly relevant to those wealthier households. Middle class people, you know, it's mostly like personal middle class assets. Your car, your home, which we're about to talk about, stuff like that. That's where like middle class wealth is. If you're really wealthy in this very high wealth bracket of families and households, that wealth is mainly in the form of financial portfolios. We have all kinds of equity or bonds and all the other financial assets that make up Wall Street activity. But just to say, finishing up with those numbers there, this is approaching Gilded Age levels of wealth concentration. We aren't quite there yet. If we get one more round of Trump tax cuts, that just about ought to close the gap. So, you know, we'll all be surprised together. We'll see what happens next year. That'll be interesting. But that's enough about the numbers. I think we're all familiar with the wealthy or very wealthy now, so we'll let that subject go for the moment and move on to the next thing I always like to get to, which is the issue of lifestyle and how wealthy people actually live their lives and what they do with the stupendous amount of money that's concentrated in their hands, and that, of course, they mostly get from those corporate dividends and other forms of passive income, mainly representing value created by workers or natural resources that was not paid out to them. So we have profit that then becomes wealthy household passive incomes. So where does the money actually go now that we know how much they have? Well, it's interesting. And it takes a while to discuss this subject because there's so many ways that families have to spend their money in bizarre, conspicuous consumption. There's so many possibilities. But of course, we should start with real estate. And just the first thing to say there is that when you look at households at this level, if you do research on them, what you discover is that wealthy households and families have this totally different relationship to real estate than what you or I have. Like for working class or middle class people, like most of your economic drama is around your home, you know, whether you're trying to make your outrageous rent with American landlords that have lost their minds and are using software to collude and drive up prices. You probably heard about that. So that's pretty impressive. And then even if you are middle class enough to get a mortgage, you know, if you've got usually at least one person to go in on it with you, a spouse or someone else, managing to barely pay your mortgage, and oh God, can we keep paying the mortgage? Oh, Betty's sick now. She had to take 2 weeks off work. How are we going to pay the mortgage this week? Ah, sorry, Junior, we can't go to the vacation destination because I've got to manage this mortgage payment. Like your economic drama is just around, can I barely continue to afford to live in this modest home or apartment? If you are wealthy, it does not look like that. And the very just first thing to recognize is, you know, for most of us, it means borrowing money to get one of those modest, you know, apartments or homes. You're saving up for years to come up with enough money for a down payment so that some bank will begrudgingly loan you the rest of the capital to make a, you know, to purchase that, and then you gradually pay them for that loan while you live in the house. Okay, if you're wealthy, you don't borrow money. You put money into the system, right? If you borrow for your credit card or your home loan, or go to college, you're a debtor, we call that, right? You owe money to some financial institution that issued the loan to you. If you're a wealthy family, you put capital into the financial system. You're a creditor. And usually you're not directly lending money to people. You know, you have a wealth advisor who has you put some money in a fund, and then a bank uses that to issue you credit card money, you know, to advance you money for a purchase. But that relationship with debt totally changes how real estate behaves for these people. Because the first thing to recognize, of course, is that a lot of the real estate purchases made by these families aren't to live in the homes, of course, it's as investments, which has definitely become a middle class thing as well lately. You buy a home not to live in it, not even to like let it out to people, but just to flip it. Just because I expect that property to increase in value and then I can sell it to someone else. So that's pretty significant. When we look at these wealthy households, we're looking at people who own multiple homes outright. And I invite you to do what I do and just take one moment and imagine what it must feel like to own your home. I can't imagine. Sounds amazing. It's definitely in reach of the citizens of a country with a $25 trillion GDP. I'm going to keep saying that until I fall asleep. That's how that'll work. But here we're looking at multiple, of course, very large or very tasteful, very expensive homes. And sometimes, because you own so many properties, you will see wealthy families that have like one of their properties was purchased with a mortgage or some kind of loan or a loan against their big capital holdings. That's popular for a lot of these households. So yeah, you may have one loan in there to kind of keep your credit rating massaged to where it needs to be. But fundamentally, with these wealthy households, it's not just owning that many homes. You own a bunch of homes, and you're usually only at each one at certain times. It's like that place in New England, well, yes, that's the summer home. The place in Florida, oh, that's the winter getaway. Very important. And it comes down to is you have many homes owned by these families, and it means they're empty most of the time, like almost all of the time. And that's an amazing thing. Again, for most of us, you know, who may have gone through long periods, or maybe some of you right now, where you have perhaps more roommates than you would ideally have in your future fantasy, you know, or living in an apartment or home that's not quite what you want, or maybe you're stuck with a partner who's slightly abusive. Like, these are the things that happen when you're unable to easily purchase real estate. But here we're talking about large real estate holdings, and they are empty for months on end. And people are on the streets, and we are hardening our hearts against people we see who are unhoused. And that's a hell of a life we inflict on those people, certainly in the U.S. And meanwhile, you have these numerous large penthouses in every city that has this issue. And the AC clicks on, and it runs quietly, and then it clicks back off. And there is no one there to observe it or enjoy it. The home is completely empty because they're not there. They're in Kennebunkport in the summer. You know, or, you know, it's a house they bought just to flip or just to store their huge assets in. It's not even about flipping or living there. It's just an asset, like a bank balance that you're letting appreciate for a while that some wealth manager, went to the purpose of buying for you. Now, the homes themselves, though, of the ruling class are pretty amazing. And there's a lot to say about this. When we look at wealthy households, you know, we're not talking about like split levels or something like that. We're looking at like real stately homes. Now, luckily, this is the United States where a lot of people, are interested in lifestyles of the rich and famous. And there's, America's sort of famous for, you know, being inoculated against socialism or a labor activism country. That's a thing people say anyway. And there's a tendency for a lot of people just to see themselves as sort of temporarily inconvenienced millionaires. Which is, a big thing. Like, oh, I'll be Bill Gates next month, though. Don't even worry. So there's a lot of interest in this as a result. And it's easy to go online and find, tours of wealthy people's homes or look how big this yacht is and so on, which is great. To me, though, by far the definitive place to go to find out the details about wealthy people's real estate is right here, this guy. Mansion. The mansion section, of course, of the Wall Street Journal. Which, being an economist, I have no choice but to subscribe to, which is great. And so this thing comes out with the paper every Friday. And online, they do not call it the mansion section. It's like real estate. I think they changed it recently. It's, like elite listings or something slightly less nakedly offensive as this is. But this thing's fantastic if you can afford a subscription or know a a coffee shop where they put out a copy of the paper. You can go and read Manchin. And it is a pretty educational reading, so I'm just going to give you a tiny taste of what you'll encounter in the pages of Manchin before we move on. So one I remember just recently was some recounting of a renovation of a large home in the Hamptons. And you all know the Hamptons, the very wealthy beachfront community on Long Island, a couple hours outside New York City. It's kind of Wall Street, bond traders, second home destination type of location. And there was a recounting in Manchin of a renovation being done on one of these old Cape Cod homes. And they mentioned that in one room alone, they had a renovation bill of $30,000 for the curtains. Just the curtains. Not like the rug or your chandelier or something like that. And I'm sure the window treatment's very attractive. But 30 grand, I guess I'd rather have a new car. Like, that's real money for middle class people. But this is for window treatment for one room in one property, which maybe you'll visit a certain number of times while you're alive. So like that's like one example. Another one I enjoyed, I think this one was from last year, just looking at a very, very large Los Angeles mansion, a very historical one, built, I think, by the Hearst dynasty, if I recall correctly. It's all in the book, of course. And they mentioned, so this is a quote from Manchin here. I'm just going to quote from them. They said the giant estate has, quote, 40 rooms, or 60 if you include the servants' quarters, and the walk-in silver, fur, and wine vaults in the basement. That's very nice. I've been meaning to get a fur vault in my own basement. Once I have a basement and a house, I'll do those things. So that's exciting. So the mansions are pretty over the top because that's where these crazy mental patients have enough room to paint their insane, you know, Charles Foster Kane castle-like visions. So you get all kinds of crazy stuff in there. But the penthouses are also another major area for this. You know, penthouse apartments, like gigantic, very fancy, very large, very expensive, top of building apartments, you know, condos, of course, that you see in like big markets everywhere, and certainly the biggest ones like, you know, New York and London and Shanghai and so on. And those are pretty interesting too. I remember Ken Griffin, the U.S. hedge fund founder, set the all-time record for price ever purchased for a residence when he bought his Grand Avenue penthouse for, $238 million. Is almost $250 million. This is enough to put up like a decent sized school, if that's of interest to you. If you have a kid, like that's how much money that costs. And if you're buying penthouses at that level, one thing I learned about from Manchin that you may also be interested in is you may need to buy parking, especially New York or London. You ever go there? Like, it's not famous for having lots of open space. You know, it's a very developed, crowded area, so parking is scarce. And so if you find listings for one of these apartments, like Manchin in the very back of the section, will have little like classified ad type of setups there. And it's for things like parking spaces that you can purchase if you're an elite property buyer, as would read that section, unless you're some creep economist like me. And they said that the parking spaces you see listed there, I mean, they vary a little bit, of course, depending on the building and so on and exactly when the listing is, but they're usually about $1 million for a place to put your car. You know, your luxury show-off car, of course, as well. It's like, that's an interesting one. And I have a ton of stories about New Yorkers and their crazy penthouses on the Upper East and then West Sides in the book, which you can take a look at. But I do have a few favorites. One of them is a 1950s Manhattanite who obviously also had her place out in the Hamptons. And even when she was in the city, when she was in her home on the Upper East Side, she would still send her butler back to the Hamptons each week to collect soil for her Pekingese peaches to poop on. Because she just really likes the yard out there. She really likes to go do her business there. You know what, Jeeves? Just drive out there every week. Don't bring back a bunch of soil at once. What are you, nuts? It'll get stale. That's not Peaches' favorite. Like, that's perhaps an interesting one. I like that. Now, of course, none of this stuff is very popular with most people. That's why figures like Bernie Sanders and the Squad can have all this surprising, to mainstream viewers, all this surprising breakout success, and why, you know, was able to suddenly do very well in all these states, including states that are thought to be inhospitable to left-wing ideas, like my great original home state of Indiana, for example. And so because this stuff is unpopular, more progressive constituencies, especially London and New York, have started requiring that some luxury property developers, if they don't want to get an unfavorable tax treatment, they have to start including in their very high-end developments at least some affordable housing units. Relatively affordable. Still, that's better than nothing, okay? And so these nice, fancy buildings, though, have to have, like, relatively middle-class units in them. That could create sort of a tone problem for the amazing development I'm doing here. And this is where we start seeing a phenomenon where developers who are subject to this regulation started putting in separate entrances for the residents of those main, of those, you know, more middle-class priced units. And if you, you read the accounts in the Times or the Guardian, it's very interesting, and not even reported with a lot of judgment, just kind of like, oh, isn't this interesting? And they mentioned that if you go through the main entrance, you know, it's a fancy building lobby, and it's all light and big windows, and the concierge is available should you need something, okay? But if you go in through doors for the middle-class units to take the elevator up to those, it's this incredibly utilitarian, off-white corridor, hideous lighting, lot of surveillance cameras, and a sign saying, you are being surveilled. If you break something, we'll take you to court, you dirty prole. I think I added that last bit, but you get the idea. And so the term that people use for this in the real estate industry, like in the property and real estate development industry, the term they use for this is poor doors. That's what that is. You have poor doors. You, a poor person, walk through the crappy one. Oh, it's ugly in here for your ugly poverty. Now go with your elevator up to your normal unit. I'll go up the fancy elevator, and I'll have the concierge clean my dog or whatever they do. Yeah, that's an amazing thing to me. And again, this is I don't have this quote in front of me. I should, obviously. Again, it's in the book. One of these just, you know, very blasé real estate figures, I believe it was in New York, she says, the reporter says, why do you have these separate doors? And she says, it's so the two social strata don't have to meet. Couldn't put it better myself. Like, that's exactly right. Yep, okay. So, like, that's sort of some interesting stuff. Again, we're looking at huge numbers of giant properties here, so it's just a totally different reality. I think that that's enough on the real estate stuff. There's a lot of more good material, though, I will say, and obviously it's in the book. For example, in 2013, you may have heard Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle Software, is a really big deal out in the Washington State, where I live now. He's a big deal out there. He bought Lanai. You know, Lanai, it's one of the Hawaiian islands. So he bought a Hawaiian island, technically just 97% of it. So if you're one of the independent citizens, great. Stand on that 3% and hope it doesn't rain, I guess. Like, it's an amazing thing when you're able to purchase that kind of land. The last thing I'll say about the real estate and homes before we move on from this is about household labor. Because, again, we got to get back to that. It's 40 rooms, unless, or 60 if you count the servants. So what about these servants? The whole section in the book about live-in staff, and it is it's just a totally different reality. We have people around you all the time in your home serving you, and they're cleaning your dirty toilets, and they're making your healthful meals, and you can chat with them, and they have to be nice to you, and they can't tell you you're a deluded idiot who's killing the world for your little luxuries. That's not so good. That's not how you get a good reference for your next job. So just pulling just a little material here, and then we'll move on from Frank Rich. If you know Frank Rich, he's another, I think he was a Bloomberg reporter, and now he's at Wall Street Journal, or it might be the other way around. It's one of those. But he has a book on the rich, which was very interesting. It's from about 20 years ago, so it's a little dated. But he's talking about a small academy in New York that trains people to do household work in very, very high-end customer markets. And I'll just quote him here about what the students learn about how to do household labor, and then we'll talk about something else. So he says, most of all, the students learn never to judge their employers, whom they call principals. If a principal wants to feed her Shih Tzu braised beef tenderloin steaks every night, the butler should serve it up with a smile. If a principal is in Palm Beach and wants to send his jet to New York to pick up a bottle of Chateau Latour from his Southampton's cellar, the butler makes it happen, no questions asked. Like, that's important. Okay, like, a lot of labor is doing labor in these kind of conditions. And that's one thing that we can think about in the future as we strategize around what we want to do with labor. Like, I would think there's a significant organizing opportunity to be had there. People who are directly exposed to the daily behaviors and follies of the very, very wealthiest people. I mean, they'd have great stories for your union meeting if nothing else. I mean, just have them over for the stories, you know, and maybe you can get a union out of that too. So there's a lot in there about the real estate and stuff, but we'll move on to some other juicy stuff. One thing I have a chapter on is wealthy people in the environment, which is interesting. And there's a lot of features to that that we can look at. One, again, I guess does relate back to real estate. There's a big home improvement market for high-end real estate improvement, what they call trophy trees. And a trophy tree is a really nice tree that you tore out of the earth somewhere and brought to your mansion and put it there instead. And the way this was described was literally to show, it was to signify your environmental credentials, which is great. It definitely does that. And it was like, and again, the reporting though, it's business reporting. So it's not like, look at these ruling class assholes, someone cut their heads off. It's always like, oh, you know, this is an interesting market here. Look how they do this. You know, there could be an investment opportunity here. Like, it's just described like you're like a scientist describing a tree or something like that. But it's difficult because these trees are at once insanely heavy, also insanely delicate. Remember, you know, I have a biology background, but you may know, like most tree species, there's as much biomass underground as above ground. So digging one of these things out without killing the hell out of it is indeed an unbelievably difficult, expensive, and labor-intensive task. So no healthcare. However, we took a tree that was very happy someplace and put it some other place so I can look at it when I'm in town once a year. So that's interesting. The big thing we look at, obviously, in that chapter, though, is climate, which has, you know, for whatever, you know, for good and bad reasons, kind of become the stand-in for the whole environmental crisis we confront. We also have extinction crisis and microplastics in our brains and so forth, which are not necessarily fantastic. But climate change has sort of, you know, moved to the front, and not unreasonably so. So it's interesting to look at that. The simplest thing, I guess, to say is that maybe unsurprisingly, the contribution of households by class to climate emissions is very close to their disproportionate consumption of goods and services, and especially ownership of that corporate stock. It's very conventional to break up emissions by like what kind of activity you do that causes them. You dirty middle class person, you caused all this pollution. I mean, most of it happens in industry, making goods and making chemicals and natural gas and plastics and medical devices and drugs. That's where most of it happens. And as we've mentioned, most of corporate America is owned by that wealthy class of households. So we see numbers like this. The wealthiest 1% of households emits 17% of all that annual greenhouse gas emissions per year by itself. The richest 10% emits 47.6% of the total, like almost half. For the wealthiest 1 in 10 households. Like, that's interesting. And I should mention, I'm using the WIDS numbers again here. They have a very good carbon accounting process for CO2 equivalents. So that stuff's pretty juicy. Now, where does that emissions come from? Obviously, you're looking at more homes with more electricity. So, I mean, the bigger household consumption is a piece of it for sure. But a lot of it comes from wealthy people getting around. Because again, you don't drive yourself anywhere. When you're in your car, you have your driver. You don't say chauffeur. That's kind of old money. That's kind of stuffy. And if there's one thing new money hates, they want the respect of people who have old money, but they don't want to look stuffy, blue bird, you know, blue blood establishmentarianism. They don't like that. Like, I'm a cool new millionaire. I have an app that lets you lock up your teachers for mentioning racism. So that's something that I invented. So I deserve this money. So, you know, you'll have your driver, not a chauffeur. My driver takes you around. But if you're going anywhere seriously, you're not driving. You're going to use one of the other ways the wealthy get around. And traditionally, like in the original Gilded Age and still today, the yacht is one of those mainest conspicuous consumption options that exist for the rich. And they get pretty big. Once the length of the boat from aft to stern is over 50 feet, we call it a super yacht. That's old hat now. So once your boat is 180 or more feet long, it's a mega yacht now. So yes, bigger, more, making up for totally no insecurities that you may have. It's fantastic. But these yachts are pretty unbelievable. So for example, the larger ones, the ones in that mega category, those guys can burn 100 gallons of diesel an hour standing still. That's before you push the go levers that they have and move. Like, that's a fair amount. And the amenities on these yachts, I mean, they're just unbelievable. You should take a look at the listing on this. I've written it up for a few places online, so you can find that. Some of my favorites were air-conditioned helicopter hangar, That was a mega yacht amenity that I thought was interesting. Bulletproof shower stalls. Mm-hmm, very clever. They already know what you are all thinking. So it's pretty smart. Pretty smart. And, oh, right. It's one of them. I forget which billionaire this was. Again, it's in the book. I don't remember anything. I put it in books, and then I just look it up there. It's much easier. One of these guys insisted, who knows why, on having a full scale, like fully licensed IMAX theater in his yacht. I don't know if you've seen an IMAX movie. Those are large, large theatrical settings with like fairly expensive and heavy machinery. And this guy wanted, like, he wanted a IMAX certified, not some knockoff. You know, I must have this real thing. Now I'm off for my, you know, lobster salad lunch. So they ended up building the IMAX theater first and then building the whole yacht around it. I always like that story. That's interesting. You know, some workers somewhere just rolling their eyes are like, all right, put the seats in and then we'll do the boat part, I suppose. This is what you have to do when you're the working class, is put up with crazy demands from megalomaniacal wealthy people. And again, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, but by now, yachts are kind of, I don't want to overdraw this point, but they're kind of being superseded by private jets. The jets aren't as flashy as the yachts, which are kind of big, floating, wealthy resorts. So it's like a different kind of showing off, though. Now, again, we're talking about private jets here, not your friend who's a retired dentist who has a jet card, which is like a timeshare for private planes. It lets you own 1/10 of a Gulfstream or a, you know, fancy teched up Cessna or something, and you get it for 1 month out of the year or something like that. Like actual privately owned jet transportation. Those things are pretty interesting on their own. They get extremely expensive. They, again, can get up into the hundreds of millions of dollars to buy those, depending a lot on exactly how fancy the plane is and how many options you have. But we have interiors with hand-woven Thai carpets, Versace china, and Christofa silver. I remember one had entire interior trim made out of alligator skin. Very classy. I like that one. That was a nice one. But it's really, really annoying because, of course, flying on a private plane is stratospherically more emissions intensive per mile than even flying commercially, let alone taking the train or something like that. All right. So usually about 10 times the emissions is what we've seen so far. And the thing is, when you look at these billionaires on these flights, it's incredibly short flights a lot of the time. Just like outrageously short flights. So for example, you had that Twitter account, that account on Twitter. I mean, X. You have to say it how Elon Musk says it in his brain. So it was an account on X, and it was tracking Elon Musk's private jet flights. Because, you know, these flights, the FAA requires a transponder, and there's a database for those, and you can look up and see who's flying where, if you can figure out whose transponder signal corresponds to their plane. It's relatively doable. And so you had that X account, Fly Elon or Elon Flight, whatever it was exactly. And, of course, Elon Musk is, I'm being doxxed by this, and just knocked that off the site. And so now if you go there, it's like, it has a day lag. So it's where Elon was 24 hours ago. So you can't go to the San Francisco airport and shoot him. Like, he was afraid that's so someone can get me, not because it's humiliatingly revealing how frequently I use my private jet. Like, last time I looked, within the last month, when I was working on the book, is over the last month he had taken 6 flights from San Mateo, like Silicon Valley, you know, San Mateo, or excuse me, San Jose, up to San Francisco. It's like less than a half hour flight. Like, that's a 20-minute ride on the BART. Like, that's nothing. You have to interact with people there. And you could, like, not even get in a car and have someone else drive you. Like, get in a plane to do that incredibly short trip. And you also have plenty of trips around the world as well. Working on the book, I came across this unbelievable gem. It was an article in a very obscure academic journal. The Annals of Tourism Research, I believe, is what it was from. Obviously, you can find the citation in the book there. And it just had a travel researcher, and he used just social media posts alone to reconstruct the private flight path history of a couple billionaires and celebrities over the last few years. And I just put those illustrations in the book because they really speak for themselves. It really depends on what billionaire or celebrity you're looking at, where they go. But they go all over the world in these crazy jets. And those long flights, you know, reflect that. But obviously, I mean, I hope it's clear, the shorter flights are more outrageous because of the waste, right? Any flight, private or commercial, the large majority of the emissions are during takeoff and landing. When you got to get that 20-ton beast up in the air and then not let it skid off the runway when you land. you know. So it's extra wasteful from that point of view. So that's interesting. And I would just say a last bit on private jets. We had a report from a British NGO, Transport and Environment is their name. Weird little name. But they discovered, just going through their own research with CEOs, they found that within European private jet use, so specifically looking at the European Union here, 41% of the flights are empty legs. You know, so there's no one on the plane, an empty leg, right? We're flying it to the bosses in Monaco, so we fly it there, and then we take him to Paris or, you know, Athens, wherever he's going. Like, not even anyone in the insanely expensive plane, obviously a pilot, of course, but like, no one in the passenger cabin. Pretty amazing. But even that is not the worst part about this, because now we have not just gigantic wasteful yachts and not insanely wasteful private planes, but we have private space travel now, which you might not think of in this connection, but you should consider it. And remember what this is. You know, we're looking at a couple, two or three billionaires here, and they have private space programs. These are things governments used to have, but now we don't tax the rich anymore for those things. So they just have their own space programs, and they fly around on those when they want, and they do very, very, very short trips usually. Usually 15 minutes or less is typical for these billionaires. And, you know, they pretend to do science, even though there's nothing to be done in that scale. You know, and you're all drinking champagne anyway. I think you're fooling us. Again, looking at the World Inequality Database here, they estimated that an 11-minute space flight using today's rocket technology, just one of these 11-minute flights, like when Bezos took William Shatner up last year, they found it can emit 75 to 200 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, meaning, and again, here I'm quoting from the WID, it therefore takes a few minutes in space travel to emit at least as much carbon as an individual in the world's bottom billion will emit in the entirety of their lifetimes. Of interest, perhaps, with all these wealthy people. And everyone knows now this has become kind of a cliche, as people go to big climate conferences and they fly in private planes. Those people should not be allowed to leave the conference, in my opinion. But, you know, that's getting outside of economics. So last thing I talk about in the book, I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff. I have a chapter looking at different wealthy people in different regions of the world, you know, comparing your Arab monarchs to your Russian oligarchs to your Latin American, you know, latifundia, huge estate owners and stuff. They all have their own characteristics, and that's kind of fun. But the last chapter is about how to try to get rid of these characters, which is of interest to a lot of us. First thing I note, obviously, is that you do have these days a lot of, like, a real renaissance happening of support for relatively radical economic measures. Now, of course, a lot of this is for fairly mild, what we would call social democracy stuff. And, of course, a lot of it got a big boost in 2016 and 20 with the Sanders campaigns and with the various members of the squad and lots of interesting state-level developments, which we have in my state and this state and plenty of others. We found that during the 2020 Sanders campaign, at least going by polls, popular support for just socialism, which, of course, a debatable term, exactly what that means. We all know that's contested territory. But just as far as the term goes, 42% of respondents said they had a positive view of socialism. A stunning figure, considering the wall-to-wall media hostility that you encounter in news, in movies, in books, in literature, in commentary, certainly on political venues. So, like, that's a strong impact there. And it's something that, again, you do see. I mean, I personally, I teach economics, which, of course, means I teach in a business program. And all the time there, I'm amazed by how much even business students are, disenchanted with markets and with capitalism. And very frequently, I go in there with my whole radicalization, you know, agenda. Speaking tongue-in-cheek, of course. I know we're taping this. And, you know, I'll go in and the students are saying, yeah, so I don't know what happened in 2008, but I say burn down the banks. And then I go, no, let's burn down those all right, good job, everybody. 10-minute break. Very nice. Good job, people. So there is a lot of support there. And we see it a lot these days, especially with the labor movement, which I think we can say is having at least a renaissance now. See how far we can push it. The further, the better, of course. I'm very happy to be in my AFT local and to be on, to be one of our reps at the Central Labor Council in my county. Little things like that just make you feel a lot less hopeless if you're actually in, I mean, any kind of labor or left-wing entity. Like, it's not just you alone on your phone, in your room, with the lights off, causing you to become more depressed. We talk to people, and it's good for you chemically. It's good for us all socially. It's very nice. And so the labor movement has come a long way, I think partially from people kind of realizing this. So now we have 331 Starbucks locations that have voted in a union. Very impressive. Those people deserve a lot of respect. Unionizing in the service sector. You know, I mean, it may not seem like just the hellish factories of, you know, Marxist Britain, but it's bad enough, man. And the techniques for breaking your unions are only fancier, of course. Now, of course, most of those don't have a collective bargaining agreement yet, because we can drag that out for a very long time in court under NLRB rules. But the vote itself is still very impressive. Even a few unionized Apple stores, which are interesting cases. I spent a little time talking about those. Because Apple, sort of like Starbucks, they don't want to just go, a union doctor, you're fired. Like, they want to have a progressive outward persona. You know, they love pride, and they like representation in their ads and so on, which are all positive things, of course. But it means then when your workers say, we want a union, you can't go, oh, dirty, subversive, get out. Technically, that's illegal, but still common anyway. So they kind of, you know, soft talk the workers, and then they do the vote and go, oh, well, our lawyers are very concerned. And next thing you know, it's a regular workplace again. Amazon, obviously, is one of the toughest nuts to crack, with only a single unionized workplace so far for the firm. And again, the reasons are clear for that, and most of these haven't changed that much since the 30s and the institutionalization of labor organization and bargaining in the U.S. But just to give an idea, this is from the Wall Street Journal again. They just mentioned that in the very early days of trying to organize that that other Staten Island warehouse that was the most recent failed attempt, high-profile failed attempt to organize an Amazon workplace. They mentioned that very early on, when they started the organization drive, very strong, very high proportions of the workforce said they were interested, and almost three-quarters of them signed union cards, which is a very strong beginning point. Like, that's not bad. But then, the erosion of that early support continued through the power of the employers in campaigning against unions by holding mandatory meetings and talking to employees during work hours about the downside of organizing. The company's slogan, "Do it without dues," was pushed to workers in text messages, your mandatory meetings, and signs in bathroom stalls. So it's just like an uphill battle, because you can always, the amount of money you give up if these guys organize and get a health plan, it's so much, you should just fire hose them with every propaganda tool that you can find because of the amount of money at stake there. And often that's successful, you know. And again, by the time a worker organizer gets to talk to you, it's been 8 hours on your shift of hearing nonstop wall-to-wall propaganda. So they definitely get the big fix in first, obviously, which makes it difficult for people. But the growth of labor these days and its growing popularity among people, very high favorability for unions these days, numbers we haven't seen since the 60s, back when labor was a much bigger part, of course, of the national political landscape and obviously people's work lives. So that's impressive. So that's very favorable. And, you know, it's through that organization that we get stuff like real left-wing political movements. So one thing I have a section on at the end of the book is how to help with these movements. And obviously, you know, you can work on organizing your workplace and getting a collective bargaining agreement in there. Not easy, but that's one way to move socialism's battle forward. But another way, of course, is just getting broad political education that's at least not utterly hostile to any kind of worker collective action there. And just for what it's worth, you know, I come from a very, I would say, like a fairly liberal family, you know, JFK type of liberals, you know. And so we like unions, that's fine, but you want markets. Your markets are efficiency and so on. Now, I've written several books about why that's not true, but putting that aside for the moment, like how you talk people into this kind of stuff, I think is something we don't necessarily give enough thought to. So just one quick thing I'll mention that I always do. You know, it's tough because people have spent, you know, their lives hearing 1984 and socialism is Stalin and thought control and everyone's poor, it's Venezuelan, it's a disaster. So how do you talk anyone into it? My motto is don't. Let someone else do it who they will be impressed by. Because we have a number of historical socialists who, because they've been totally cleansed of their radical politics by media presentation, have kind of become like basically American secular saints. And if you just quote some of their socialism loving to people, that really, really can, at least in my experience, that really can pry open the door. Like, let that be the hard tip of the spear there. And then, you know, you can run with that. So just as an example here, you know, I said this to my own liberal mother at one point. So like, oh, socialism, that's, you know, I like that Bernie, but I don't know about that socialism, Rob. I said, well, you know, who's the, you know, you don't want Stalin controlling thoughts and everything. Who's the definitive English language critic of Stalinism and totalitarianism? George Orwell, of course.
everyone's heard of 1984, and maybe read Animal Farm in school or something like that. And you can hit them with those dynamite 1940s Orwell quotes about how every line of nonfiction I have written is against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism as I understand it. And I did, I'm sure like many of you, I did have a history book, or it might have been an English book, whatever, as a kid, that included that quote and cut off the last part. That's just, like, that's, I assume that's the Texas Board of Education's influence there. Like, that is, like, that's just criminal. That's like taking someone's speech and cutting off the second bit of it. Like, that should be against, maybe not against the law, but that's a strong medicine, let's say. So I also like Orwell's quote. He wrote a whole book about why Britain should adopt socialism right after World War II that no one remembers and you should take a look at. It's like 50 pages. It's very short. The Lion and the Unicorn, or it might be the Unicorn and the Lion. It's been a long day. He says in there, the only positive thing for which we can combine is the underlying ideal of socialism, justice and liberty. Oh, so good. Like that's... That'll stop your liberal friend in their tracks and make him think. And when that, you know, once that happens, then you open up with the full Einstein, as they say, right? Einstein's famous article or essay, I guess, from the Monthly Review, saying, yes, private capital tends to become concentrated in few hands. Under existing conditions, private capitalists also control, directly or indirectly, the main sources of information. So I am convinced there's only one way to eliminate these grave social evils, through the establishment of a socialist economy. In such an economy, the means of production are owned by society itself and utilized in a planned fashion. Like, Einstein's a secular saint in this country. You know, you buy your dumb kid a poster of Einstein to put up in their room so maybe they'll be smart. You know, like, that is a big deal in the United States. And then, you know, once that works, hit him with the other big socialists of recent modern history. Give him Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Malala from Pakistan. Like, there's many, many ways to go there, depending on their exact liberal bent or conservative bent. So I just recommend that. I just want to put that in here, basically. So the last thing we mentioned for this panel was how to get rid of the wealthy. I totally know all the answers to that question. I can tell them all to you. I would just say we all know the basic outlines here, right? I mean, first, we need a much stronger labor movement than we have today, which is why I start with that. And there's a lot to do for the labor movement. We have a lot of great panels here this weekend from people who are way more full-time organizing than me, and they can tell you a lot more about that than I can, so let them do that. And doing that in tandem with a lot of public education to widen support for socialism, which is happening. And you may or may not love Sanders as a figure, you know, like any political figure, he has some strengths and some weaknesses, but I think one thing you really can say is that his candidacies, along with, you know, the various members of the House, have really put popular socialist ideas in front of people. I mean, Medicare for All, very achievable program, 88% of Democrats support it. I mean, that should just have to become the party platform at that point, you might think. And more than half of Republicans support it. Like, my God, that's pretty strong. And, you know, you cannot have anyone who runs away from it faster than Kamala Harris now that she's actually close to power. During her abominable 2020 run, you could pretend to support it because who cares? You have no donors. You have no support. Your campaign doesn't even reach the first primary. You could be in favor of full communism then. Who cares? Now I'm actually powerful. Oh, I would like to keep getting checks from drug makers and the hospital chain. So I think we need access to health care, a meaningful phrase that means something. So that's pretty interesting. But then finally, I mean, we need more socialist political representation, obviously, in whatever form. The United States is such an inherently hostile to democracy republic from its very creation in the Constitution all the way to today, through state, you know, through party control of their state ballot lines. Outrageous that we allow this to continue. So that's, these are all very difficult steps, but just to give us like the broadest idea. But finally, I would just say, and I include this in the book, like, there is the line where social democracy and democratic socialism sort of meet, at least as I've always understood that term. Social democracy, like Northern Europe, you know, we still have markets, most property is still private. Most industrial assets, most even including energy in most of those countries, usually not transportation, that's usually right around where that line is. That stuff remains private property, more regulated certainly than the United States, and with fortunes taxed a lot more so they can have all those nice European amenities that look so amazing to us Americans, like guaranteed health insurance and you know, public pensions and stuff like that when you're aged, or if you lose your job or get disabled, you can have a pension without fighting with Social Security and getting a tiny, tiny morsel as a result. But the big margin between that kind of social democracy, which would be great, and democratic socialism, I would suggest, is expropriation. Like, that is the line between I'm reforming a mainly capitalist system versus we're completely changing the system and we're going to have something different now. Expropriation, of course, is kind of an economics-y and political science term for taking large assets from somebody, right, and giving them to someone else. And when you have revolutions, often that's about expropriating someone and giving it to someone else. Now, it may not be successful, but like that's what the idea is, you know? And there's a lot to say about that. In the United States, there's a lot of support for the one really big expropriation that we did at the end of the Civil War, when we took wealthy people's slave property away. Most people now really feel like that was the right thing to do. Lincoln remains one of the most popular presidents, and it's not because of his tariff policy. It's because he played a major role, at least, in extending freedom to tens of millions of Americans who, until that point, you could buy and sell them. You could sell their kids. Like, that's fairly ugly, but we expropriated those people and made them independent citizens. And they've had no problems in America ever since, obviously. Yeah. I joke around. But the point is, like, that was a positive step that occurred. That is the expropriation we ever did. I just feel we should have somewhat more of those and take that big private property away and make it perhaps national property through a nationalization, or have it run through the workforce, or make it belong to the community in some form. There's a lot of possible ways you can conceive of that organization and ownership and control running. It's a country, you know, this is the United States, it's an experimental kind of pioneering vibe. This would be a good country for socialism because you could have a bunch of people trying it in different fun ways and see, like, oh, that was very successful. Oh, let's not do that. Like, that's really valuable when you're doing big social changes like that. You know, but expropriation is that step. And again, this is something that confuses a lot of people. Like, oh, the government's going to come and take your toothbrush and your gas grill. Like, we're talking about big private property here and not what we call personal or sometimes petty property. No one wants your personal toothbrush and the bed you sleep on. But if you own a large manufacturing complex or a oil refinery or a plastics plant or a giant data center to keep our YouTube latencies low, like, that's big physical capital. And ownership of that stuff puts you in a position of, I mean, just incredible social and economic influence, as we all know. So just to finish with that, I would say, like, that ought to be the goal, at least in my view. The long-term goal, I don't know if we'll necessarily get it this year, but it should be something about taking that private property away from the rich. The reason they were able to come back and bring back the Gilded Age, as they're sort of doing now, is because we never expropriated them in this country or Western Europe. I mean, the Swedes were pretty close. If we and the Brits hadn't kind of stopped them, I think they would have managed to reform capitalism away by gradually nationalizing more of that productive capital. So now we'll never know, of course. You could see of different ways of doing it like that. But that's where that line is. Like, again, private capitalists still maintained ownership of media. And Rupert Murdoch could come in the early 80s and buy and build up Fox News. That's power. Like, this is what I say to my libertarian economics colleagues, of which I have sadly many, just to say, like, that's power. It's not just the state that has power. Obviously, governments have power. Everyone can see that. But if I'm a senator, I have power, but it's limited. There's very strict constitutional limits on what my power is and what I can and can't do. If you're a billionaire, there's no limit on the numbers, on the number of dollars that you can have, and you can buy the Washington Post, like Jeff Bezos, or Twitter, like Elon Musk, or like Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg's giant information company. You can buy those things up, and now you're shaping the ideas that people hear. Like, if that's not power, I don't know what is. But when you leave people in that position, they can wait 30 years until it's the 70s, and people are more annoyed about inflation then than their memories of the Depression and the problems of unregulated capitalism, and you vote in Reagan and Thatcher, and there you go. If we hadn't left them in that position of owning the sources of power in a big industrial society, we wouldn't be looking at trying to fight battles that we thought we finished back in, like, the 1930s. You know, so there's a lot more to say about that. I have big sections on the ruling class psyche and on philanthropy, which is interesting itself. We can see what you all guys want to talk about there. I think that's enough, you know. So I'll just finish this for now just by saying, you know, when you're learning about the ruling class, you know, you should be skeptical of them and their power and what they've brought the world to. At the same time, though, I think it's just very easy in any kind of politics, and certainly on the left, just get super serious. Like, there's a certain tendency in politics to be super serious because it's a serious subject. Lives are at stake, after all. So the tendency is for it to become serious and, like, unfun. So I would just say, just for my part, and it's easy for me with my white face to say that, of course, I recognize that. But I would just say, like, when we're doing this political activity, we should try to find what is fun in it. Like, past successful social movements, from, you know, women's suffrage to civil rights to everything else, like, came with their own, like, joyful might be the wrong word, but, like, with their own kind of playful aesthetic. And how we're rising up against this historic evil, and we draw on this faith tradition or on this community or whatever it is to get through it. Like, that's important. So I would just say, as you're studying and fighting the ruling class, you know, have a laugh at their expense. They can afford it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.